When you need mealtime inspiration, it's worth shopping Kroger, where you'll find over 30,000 mouthwatering choices that excite your inner foodie. And no matter what tasty choice you make, you'll enjoy our everyday low prices, plus extra ways to save, like digital coupons worth over $600 each week. You can also save up to $1 off per gallon at the pump with fuel points. More savings and more inspiring flavors make shopping Kroger worth it every time. Kroger, fresh for everyone. Fuel restrictions apply.
This episode is brought to you by Snapple. Want to know another Snapple fact? The first hot air balloon passengers were a sheep, a duck, and a rooster. Ridiculous. Check out Snapple.com to find ridiculously flavored Snapple near you.
Hello.
Hey.
Hi. I'm sorry, I'm running out again. The story of my life.
You want to get in the car? I can stay on hold or whatever. I'm just...
This is a call between a woman named Susie Giordano and filmmaker Andrew Jarecki. It took place the week after episode 5 of part 1 of The Jinx aired. Susie and Andrew talked about the episode's implications for Bob.
Bob killed Susan. Right? We know that now. It doesn't get better in episode 6, Susie.
So maybe I just, like, live in denial, or I see what I want to see, or I don't know.
Susie and Bob were longtime friends, and Susie always saw the best in Bob. She says that's because she's a loyal person.
I would never walk away from you. If I'm really fond of you, I could never, no matter what you would ever do, could I just walk away from you. It's just not within me. I just don't know why. Even Andrew, if you came to me and said, oh my God, I killed 10 people, I would say, well, Andrew, thank God it wasn't 11.
Hi, I'm Zach Stewart-Pontier, one of the filmmakers behind HBO's The Jinx. Welcome to the official Jinx podcast. A show where we take you behind the scenes of Andrew Jarecki's documentary series that became a real-life murder investigation. Today we're exploring the second episode of Part 2, Chapter 8, Friendships Die Hard. This episode introduced us to several of Bob's friends as Deputy DA John Lewin attempted to get them to cooperate with his prosecution. And by the end, one flipped. Andrew and I got into the recording studio to talk about the hold Bob managed to keep over so many of his friends.
A lot of these people were under Bob's spell or under Bob's control. And you know, you and I have talked about this, I don't think it's all about money.
Yeah.
Money's important, but it's just one of the things that makes somebody feel loyalty.
Yeah.
But if you think of all the things that made these people fall under Bob's spell, it's not a surprise that it takes a long time for that to recede. Mm.
One of Bob's best friends, who's introduced in Chapter 8, is Nick Chavin. He's actually someone Andrew has known about for years.
There was talk during season 1 of Nick Chavin participating, right?
I had said to Bob, I need to talk to some people who are your friends. And then he had sort of pushed Nick to talk to me, and then it wasn't happening, and I would call Nick. And, you know, I would learn later that trying to get through to Nick is like trying to get an audience with the Pope.
Even Bob had a hard time pinning down Nick Chavin, but he does get him on the phone during part 1 of The Jinx in Chapter 5 when Bob goes into Starbucks and his phone rings.
Hello. Oh, Nicky, how are you?
At the time, Andrew got Nick on the phone, too, but he wouldn't agree to an interview.
Hello?
Andrew?
Hey.
Hi, Nick, hi.
Good.
You know, I really wanted to do this.
Yeah.
I care a lot about Bob, and I'm going to try and talk.
All right, I got it.
Can you call me, like, in a week or two?
Yeah, I mean, I would say better a week than two.
A week, good. Now, let's keep this thing hot. Listen, I really think I can do this.
Yeah.
In any event, he doesn't participate. A long time later, after The Jinx is out and Bob is arrested, I run into Nick Chavin. And I say, oh, it's a shame we didn't get together. And he's like, a shame? It was the worst thing that ever happened to me in my life. And I said, what do you mean? And he said, well, not being in the show. It was the biggest mistake I've ever made.
Nick's chance would come in The Jinx Part 2. He and Andrew sat down for multiple interviews. And Nick shared a little bit about what drives him.
Ever since I can remember, all I've ever wanted was to be famous. I formed a band and I became Chinga Chavin. And Chinga is a Spanish phrase. Are you aware of that?
No.
Okay, the literal translation is fuck you. I came up with a hook. Sexy and ribald country and western songs. Come for Peter, come for Paul, come for Mary too. And if you come twice, Jesus Christ will bless you. Da, 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 da.
What were some of the other song titles?
Okay, Talking Matamoros, First Piece Ass Blues. Sit, 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 sit on my face. Tit Stop Rock was a trustless trucking song in there. Vennies and Beer.
And what was the mission? I mean, what were you trying to do with the music?
What was the mission?
Were you trying to send a message? Were you trying to...
Yes. Let's eat, fuck, and play the violin, because tomorrow we'll all be nitrogen. I'd say that was the message. And no, the message was I want to get rich.
And during that conversation, Andrew asked Nick possibly the riskiest question he's ever asked anyone in his whole filmmaking career.
Should we listen to Cum Stains on My Pillow?
On the pillow. Try not to besmirch the song.
Cum stains on the pillow, where your sweet head used to be. The music's great.
If you're Nick and you want to be famous and you're maybe not a particularly good guitar player, which maybe it's fair to say that based on our experience with Nick, you know, he liked to shock.
Yeah, yeah.
There's no question.
That was the whole thing, yeah.
Tell me about Nick's custom guitar.
He decided that it would be cool for him to have a guitar that was not only in the shape of a toilet seat, but was essentially made of an actual toilet seat. He thought it was a great hook.
Called it Potty.
But, you know, the idea of being able to do something that's shocking and gets people to pay attention to you is something that clearly worked for Nick.
It really did work for Nick. His act quickly got the attention of a certain kind of press.
The second time I was ever on stage, Playboy wrote about it in Playboy After Dark. Sex and country music was so ripe. Every skin magazine in the world wrote articles about me.
And then Nick met an up-and-coming journalist.
At some point, Susan Berman came to a performance, and she wrote some reviews of my act. She liked it, and she was a powerful journalist then. So Susan and I became friends through promoting my career.
Nick Chavin and Susan Berman became fast friends.
And she taught me how to live wealthily in Manhattan. I didn't have the faintest fucking idea. Once we went to a restaurant, the Lanes, I was in my stage clothes. I had cowboy boots and I had a Western shirt. And rhinestone pants that matched it. People were stepping by and talking to us, and Susan said to me, Chinga, they think you're really famous. They have no idea. You're not really famous. And she said, just play it up. She really was a hoot.
Susan eventually introduced Nick to her friend, Bob Durst.
Chinga, she always talked like that. I want to introduce you to a really good friend of mine. He's my best friend, Bob Durst. And she said something to the effect like, well, now you two naughty boys can have fun.
So I think Nick is an example of somebody who really was in Bob's thrall. You know, he really was under Bob's spell. I think it was a big part of Nick's identity that Nick had an important friend, the scion of one of the big families, you know, arguably the biggest family, right? And so for Nick, that was like a big seal of approval.
He's a very difficult person to get to know, but once you get to know him as a best friend, you can't let go of that.
Bob talked about his friendship with Nick Chavin in his original interview for The Jinx.
Well, Nick Chavin and I, our relationship was based on two things, real estate and marijuana. That's what we would do. We would get stoned and go out and hang out and do guys' things.
We liked the same things, and we disliked the same things. And we liked insulting the cultures and the prevailing mores of the time a lot. We just both did it a lot.
Bob was always like, oh, you can come to this party or you can come into Xenon because my family owns the building or whatever. So I think anything Nick could have done to get Bob in on an interesting experience, Nick was probably down to do.
And Bob and Nick definitely ended up in some interesting experiences together.
Even though he's wealthy Bobby Durst, I got him to get involved in some of the weirdest shit he ever knew, I think. We went to a client of mine's video show that he did naked in bed with his wife called Dan Lander's Midnight Interludes, it was called.
A nude talk show? You've got it on Channel J. It's hosted by a married couple who run a sexual swingers club.
Bob and I and Ron Jeremy and two girls were all fucking each other in a closet in the bedroom where the show was going on in the living room. And I remember Ron Jeremy said, well, let's drop trow. I'd never heard that phrase before. So that's the kind of thing that Bob could have never done that with any other friends of his.
But there's only so much money Nick could make as an R-rated country porn musician. So Bob helped him get a job as a blazer-wearing ad man.
He said, hey, Nicky, We're building this building, this office building at 1155 Avenue of the Americas. You can do the advertising for it. I didn't know how to do the advertising or a brochure or a floor plan or the signage or any one of a dozen pieces of things that we built for. People plan presentations for months to get in to see someone the size of Durst and get that, what's going to be $1 million in advertising, that client. And he just said, hey, Nicky, we've got this building. If you want to do the advertising, you can. I'll give it to you. And that's how he gave me my career. That's why I owe Bob forever for that. It's a debt that can't really be worked off.
So he gets started in real estate, and Bob really helps him out. And he ends up doing some Trump ads. He ends up working for Trump.
Yeah. I think Nick always sort of prided himself on, well, Trump listened to me. You know, I imagine if you asked Trump about him now, he would say, who?
There was a time before he was political where everyone hated Trump except me. One of the things I never forgot is when he was planning Trump Hotel and Residences at the corner of Central Park, I said, do you really want to focus on it, on the hotel part? He said, Nick, everyone wants to live in a hotel. Make no doubt, everyone wants it. And I'd never thought about that, but it rang so absolutely truthful. And he was right about that.
Nick's real estate advertising business started picking up steam. He actually won some awards for his Trump campaign, and eventually, he expanded the company.
We sort of hired her because we needed a flunky. She worked for me as an ad man. I mean, she did a little typing, a little of this, a little of that.
In the early 90s, Nick hired Susie Giordano.
Nick was, he was funny. We were all just getting out of college. We were all just finding jobs. He was a lot of fun to be with. You know, when you were out socially, he was never angry, ever. He couldn't do anything wrong. You know, work, it was so serious. You know, there was no mistakes. You know, and then all of a sudden you go out and see this whole other side to him.
And then one day, as luck would have it, Susie ran into Bob.
I first met Bob on the elevator. We started talking. When I first seen him, I was 20. He was the one everyone was talking about. here it was. This was, you know, a grown man who has already worked, has done everything already that could teach you so much, has already traveled, has so much to share with you.
Andrew asked Susie when she found out about Bob's checkered past. By now, Bob's wife, Kathy, had been missing for about a decade.
And what did you learn about his life, about his background, about his the kind of background that he came from?
I actually didn't know a lot of things about Bob when I met him. I didn't know. Nick actually brought it to my attention, any, you know, things about his background, because I asked if he was married, and that's what he said. Well, he was, and then I was filled in with his marriage in the 80s.
How did Nick describe that to you?
He just said he's not married anymore. When I asked if he was married, that was the response. Nick said that he's not married right now. So I didn't ask. He didn't tell me, so.
Eventually, Susie Giordano would learn just about everything there was to know about Bob Durst. Here's Andrew talking about her in an unreleased interview back from part one.
Susie was kind of Bob's assistant, friend, somebody who had been available to Bob for many years to kind of help him with his affairs. And that he had shipped all of the many, many, many file boxes of material from his life and his trial in Texas and so on to her house in upstate New York.
Exit left for I-87 North.
Yeah.
300 feet, 200 feet.
So I called Susan Giordano and she said, sure, I'm up here in Monroe, New York. And if you want to drive up here, there's a lot of stuff, but you know, you're going to need some time because there are a lot of boxes.
A bunch of the Jinx crew drove up to Susie's house and spent the entire day going through over 60 boxes of Bob Durst's personal artifacts.
And we went up to see Susie, and Susie was incredibly warm. And she said, here's my basement. There are 60 file boxes down there of all of Bob's stuff. And you should go down there. Bob said it's okay. And do what you like.
This is a copy of, well, this is the original of Bob's will.
This was all happening with Bob's permission.
We did it, boys. How many scans did you take?
It took more than 300.
Kyle?
I don't know.
From 600 to 900 scans.
Scanned out.
Hey, how are you?
I'm fine, how are you?
This is a jail call between Susie Giordano and Robert Durst. It's 2015, and Bob's just been arrested on the eve of the final episode of part one of The Jinx.
The lawyers put together that stuff for us. One of them is titled Jarecki Timeline.
Yes.
And it goes right up to just about when I'm arrested.
The two of them are piecing together what exactly the Jinx's role was in Bob's arrest.
How did the bad guys know that I had left all those boxes of stuff up there at your house?
Andrew.
On the day of the final episode, Andrew and producer Mark Smerling got word that the police were on their way to Susie's house to seize Bob's boxes.
We learned that a team from Westchester County Police are going to go to Susie Giordano's house. They were going to go out there and pick up the boxes.
Looks like we missed him.
We got there, I think, moments after the police had left, and the police had left with the boxes. And I remember Susie being pretty shaken up and wanting to talk about what had just happened. She was pretty upset. And I said to her,
listen, on my laptop, I have the last episode of The Jinx. It's not going to play now for another couple of hours, but I want you to see it before it does.
Kill them all, of course.
Tell me what that feels like.
I don't know what to say. Well, I mean, he knows that I don't need them 100%. You know.
I get that. Yeah, that's why I wanted to show it to you.
I'm surprised. I don't know.
Yeah.
I am. I know it sounds stupid, right?
I don't think it's stupid.
She got very emotional and was crying when she was watching it. And it just seemed like it was going to be very hard for her to watch that and not have a completely different perspective on a lot of her conversations with Bob.
And I think them all, even Kathy, when he said them all, every conversation, like she's up in the conversation so much that you think that he absolutely adored her.
I think she felt like she was at risk. You know, she felt like whatever she had been helping Bob with that maybe she had not known or conveniently not known or, you know, however she had gone through the process of being Bob's special helper, suddenly it was not looking like a great job.
I don't think he's ever really put me in a bad position. I mean, but again, he has put me in a bad position. That's why I believed everything.
And her husband, who is a lovely guy, had said to me at one point, is she okay?
And I'm sorry, I don't mean to interrupt.
No.
Make sure she's all right.
So he knew that this was a maelstrom. And he knew that she had gotten herself into a mess. And he had known, you know, for years that she had this kindly elder fellow who used to be asking her to do stuff all the time and provided some income for the family. And, you know, maybe it seemed relatively harmless.
He's been quirky for so long now. Just plain quirky. And I think some of the things he's asked you for haven't been extraordinary.
But we also know that, you know, they were flirting with a guy who had clearly, maybe, at that point, killed a bunch of people.
There's like this 1% chance, you know, somebody didn't do it. So you always give somebody the benefit of the doubt. I think I should better judge a character.
After you leave, she calls you. She calls you and she's freaked out.
Well, and at some point she says to me, I did something.
Yeah.
You know, what I'm trying to find out from you is, what are you afraid of? There's something that you're afraid of because you helped Bob do something and at the time it seemed innocent and now you think it wasn't.
I went into the apartment, I got my stuff out, I got it totally freaked, you know? I was always stuck at midnight. And just, oh God, Andrew, you don't know.
It's likely that the thing that may have seemed innocent to Susie at the time was mailing a package to Bob as he prepared to flee the country. A package was intercepted by the FBI. Turns out, it contained over $100,000 in cash, which Susie claimed not to have seen.
But you knew there was some money in the bag.
How much could have been in there? I figured, I don't know, $1,000, if anything.
Susie's support for Bob seemed to waver when she watched The Jinx. But by the time she spoke to the prosecutor, John Lewin, she was back on Team Bob.
As you sit here right now, do you have a belief as to whether or not Bob killed Susan?
I don't believe he did.
Okay.
I'm sorry.
No, I know everyone's here.
On the other hand, when Nick Chavin spoke to John Lewin, he seemed more conflicted.
You said that you've been trying to
call me. I have. I've been leaving messages on all three of the numbers that I've got.
So today's the first time I've heard from you.
But if I just ask you straight out, Nick, do you think that Bob killed Susan?
But Lewin and his team kept at it.
Hi, is this Nick Chavin?
Is this John Lewin?
It is, yes.
Okay, is this about a jaywalking ticket about 10 years ago I got in Los Angeles? I'm kidding, John. Okay, sir.
That's good.
Lewin's pretty sure that Nick has information that's crucial to cracking the case. So he's very patient in these conversations. So patient that he ends up learning a lot about Nick's life.
Maybe you heard of country porn.
Country, you know what? I will be honest with you.
Is that a band?
I'm more of a sports guy.
Yeah, I'm a 49ers fan, right?
Actually a Seahawk fan. So it's been
Seahawks, yeah, that's pretty good. I like the Seahawks.
To know Lewin is to know he's a bulldog. You know, if you had to compare him to any animal, it wouldn't be a deer. It would be a bulldog. He kept at it for a long time.
Every time we talk to you, it seems to me, usually, you know, we take one step forward, sometimes two back, sometimes two forward. You're not calling us, Nick. No one is. You're not snitching anybody out.
Yeah, who is this?
Hey, it's John Lewin and Habib Balian.
Nick Chavin went to Argentina last night.
You know what? It's funny, because you must be his twin brother.
Lewin's persistence paid off, but he did get some help from someone very close to Nick.
At a certain point in time, Nick Chavin's wife, Terry, contacted us and basically told us that Nick had more information than what he was saying.
I was so frustrated with Nick. He believed Bob for so many years. He was so loyal.
According to Nick's wife, Terry, Nick was withholding key information about Susan Berman's murder. And it all went back to that dinner Bob and Nick had together in 2014.
It was really obvious that something happened at that dinner. Nick came home and was really angry. He had to really wake up, let's say.
What do you do when your best friend kills your other best friend?
As Nick considered testifying against his old friend Bob, there was one story in particular that he kept thinking about. Years earlier, he had asked Susan Berman for a very important favor.
We asked Susan Berman if she would accompany our daughter, a 6-year-old daughter. This made me forever grateful to Susan Berman.
Susan flew across the country with Nick's young daughter.
And she describes the plane trip out. About every 10 or 15 minutes, Brandy would say, is Daddy going to be there? Yeah, are we going to see my daddy? Is Daddy gonna? I mean, she was anxiety-ridden because she'd never been separated like that. And Susan lovingly brought her. It makes me cry now. I was just forever grateful. Ultimately, I felt like I was being disloyal to Susan's memory and what I owed her by not coming forth and telling him the truth.
John?
Nick!
I wanted to tell you that after thinking about this a lot, I want to come forth and tell you the truth. It's not because of you or Terry or anyone else. I thought about this a lot.
I gotta stop being protective of Bob Durst. Oh. Friendships die hard.
Nick's friendship with Bob had been dormant for about a decade, from the early 2000s until Bob reached out to him with a dinner invitation that Nick accepted.
Nick describes that he walked into the restaurant, Barrow Wine in Harlem, and it's a time when he hasn't seen Bob in a long, long time. And he sees Bob, and I think he says that he just sort of waits for a minute and just watches him.
So I walked in, and he was already there, and he was sitting, and I hadn't seen him in a while, some years. He was sitting there alone, and I looked at him for a few minutes, and I told the maitre d', I said, geez, I haven't seen this friend of mine in a few years. She sort of smiled, and later when we sat down, she brought us a bottle of champagne.
Nick says that Bob was in a reflective mood that night.
He told me directly, he said, I have wasted my life. I said, no, you haven't, Bob. I mean, I was just trying to make him feel better. He says, yes. I said, no, you haven't. He said, yes, I have.
There's so many other things I could have done. I just completely threw it all away. Wasted my life.
You know, in a way, he was right to want to savor that because it's going to be that night. That's going to be a big revelation. It's going to change his perception of Bob forever. I think Nick knew this might be the end of something.
Yeah.
Next time on the Official Jinx podcast, the trial begins and Nick testifies about what else Bob said at that dinner.
We walked out the door. This is hard. We walked out the door, and on the sidewalk, I said, "You wanted to talk about Susan."
That's next time on the Official Jinx podcast. The Official Jinx podcast is hosted by me, Zach Stewart Pontier. It's produced by ZSP Media and Hit the Ground Running Films with HBO. Watch episodes of The Jinx and stream The Jinx Part 2 on Max. This episode was produced by Laura Newcomb, Ethan Oberman, and Ramoy Phillip. The rest of our team is Naomi Brauner. The supervising producer is Liz Stiles.
Mixing and engineering by Zach Schmidt. It was recorded by Brett Tubin at Relic Room in New York City. Music by Wes Dylan Thornton and John Cusiak. Additional music courtesy of HBO.
The executive producers are Andrew Jarecki and me, Zach Stewart Pontier. Special thanks to Michael Gluckstadt, Ali Cohen, Aaron Kelly, and Savon Slater at HBO Podcasts. And the fabulous Jinx team, Sam Neve, Kyle Martin, Richard Hankin, Charlotte Kaufman, Susan Lazarus, Annabelle White, Pedro Vital, Jesse Herman, Michaeli Zabarfian, and Nako Narder. And thanks to Roe Dillon, George Vogel, Charlie Wessler, Nancy Jarecki, and Emily Wiedemann. And you, thank you for listening and making it all the way through the credits. And as a little treat / punishment, here's more of Nick Chavin's music.
Sit, Sit, Sit on My Face is my least favorite song on the record. All of Our Love leaves a wonderful taste. Won't you sit, 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 sit on my face? It's too overt. You know what I mean? I always, part of my style was to be subtle.